I'm Alex Cragen, writer and copy editor of Slug, and you're listening to Slug Soundwaves, the official podcast for Slug Magazine in Salt Lake City, Utah. Slug, an acronym for Salt Lake Underground, is one of the oldest independent publications in the United States, covering music, lifestyle, arts, and events. Today, I'm speaking with Utah House Representative Johnny Anderson about the fallout from the latest legislative session. Anderson has been a member of the House for 6 years now, primarily serving the cities of Taylorsville, West Valley City, and Murray. He's also chair of the House Transportation Committee. Thank you, Representative, for joining us today.
You bet. Happy to be here.
How's life post-session?
It's been nice. No early meetings, you know, not staying up at the Capitol for 12 hours. It's been nice.
Nice. So, we'll be talking briefly about some of the major issues that came up during the legislative session. The first one, I think, that's on everybody's mind is Healthy Utah and just Medicaid expansion. Can you go ahead and give us an overview of what exactly happened this year?
Sure. You know, we know for the past couple of years the governor's been working on his Healthy Utah initiative. It passed the Senate, but it stalled in the House. I'm a fan of Healthy Utah. I think, the response that the governor put together for the Affordable Care Act was an outstanding proposal, one that would worked very well here in the state, but my colleagues in the House, they had some concerns. And I'll tell you honestly, as I sat through caucus meetings and had conversations with other members, trying to, explain to them why I thought Healthy Utah was the right way to go, their biggest concern was the level of discomfort they have with partnering with the federal government on something like this. They say, you know what? Yeah, in the beginning, there's no federal match, but the state does have to come up with millions of administrative dollars. And by the time 6 or 7 years down the road that we're at a 90-10 match with the feds, they don't really trust that the federal government will keep up their end on the 90%, really.
And that was my observation that during the years. Primarily, the concern was whether or not the federal government was going to be there come 2 years from now.
Yeah, a lot of people have tried to make this a partisan issue or saying because, it was an Obama thing, that there was no way that the representatives would support it. And I'll tell you, last year, as this was being discussed initially, there was some sense of that. And there are certainly members of the House who are just saying, we're not going to be any part of advancing the Affordable Care Act here in the United States. But really, when it came down to it this year, when we were, in the trenches really trying to battle this thing out, it was they were so concerned that 90-10 match may be unsustainable, and if we're providing a benefit to Utahns and the federal government decides later on to scale back from 90% to 85 or 80 or even 70 like the rest of Medicaid's match is, that something that could be in the tens of millions of dollars all of a sudden becomes hundreds of millions of dollars. Mm-hmm. and they felt like it was a the possibility for being unsustainable was too great. Really, that's what it came down to.
When I was following this, Healthy Utah's been kind of talked about since prior to November.
Sure.
I remember the governor made a major push for it prior to the legislative session, kind of gave it to the Senate and gave it to Senator Shiozawa and kind of let it coast and hope that it would pass in the Senate. It passed in the Senate and then, kind of picked up legs from there.
Right.
And then it was a matter of negotiating with the House on this and the Utah Cares bill that Representative Dunnigan had proposed.
Right.
And that passed in the House but didn't really gain legs in the Senate, if I remember right.
No.
And so my question is, there was clearly no solution on the floor, and right now there's talk between the governor and Senate and House leadership. To me, I interpret it as like in a political scope of that the governor was kind of giving those that voted against Healthy Utah political coverage for a potential solution down the road.
Yeah, maybe. And it wouldn't be surprising for the governor to offer, something like that. I believe that, the speaker and the Senate president and the governor are going to take some time, look at what we need in the state, what they believe we can afford in the state, and what they believe can get passed through the House and the Senate, and come up with some sort of a solution that will at least be passable. Now, will it cover as many people as Healthy Utah would have covered? No, obviously not. I don't think it would provide even as good or as rich a benefit as Healthy Utah would have provided, but we need to do something. And
right.
I think clearly that's the direction that we're headed in.
So the governor and House and Senate leadership gave a deadline of July 31st to come up with a solution. What do you think it's going to look like come, because they said they plan on doing a special session in August.
Yeah, that's what they've talked about. I would think that it's going to look a little bit more like the Utah Cares proposal that Representative Dunnigan has been working on. That really seemed to be about as far as the majority of Republicans in the House were willing to go. It took a lot of work on the part of Representative Dunnigan to get many Republican members to even be willing to go that far. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you, the first time that we really looked at this as a caucus kind of early in session, there were more people in favor of doing nothing at this point than even doing, you know, what Utah Cares, the Utah Cares proposal. So I would tend to think it's going to look fairly similar to that.
Yeah. No, definitely. I mean, I remember the last night of the session, there was the House resolution,
yes,
too, about, and there was a line that said, you know, that doing nothing was not the right way. And I remember Representative Andrag even still was pointing out that doing nothing was still an option, which is still, I remember it being very interesting, and it wasn't well received by the body, which.
Yeah.
Yeah, on to that. So there are two bills that you sponsored that affect people that are like young people, particularly in Salt Lake City. One of them is transportation funding,
sure,
public transportation funding, as well as your bill about bike funding, I'm sorry, bike drive-throughs and cities like that.
Right.
So could you give me any kind of an explanation of your first one, which is the bike drive-through?
Yeah. Okay. So as you guys know, Salt Lake City passed an ordinance last year that required any businesses with a drive-through window to either provide, allow cyclists to utilize their drive-through window or keep their lobby open the same hours as their drive-through window. And then the other part, there were two ordinances passed. The other ordinance said that any future businesses that had a drive-through or any existing businesses with a drive-through that were going to be doing any remodeling or upgrading, they would have to also allow walk-up customers to utilize the drive-through under the same scenario or keep their lobby open. I mean, we've seen over the past few years more and more restaurants with drive-throughs keeping their drive-throughs open later and later. You know, mm-hmm. It's a service that, you know, clearly the market is asking for, and so they've been willing to expand those hours. But yeah, sometimes if you're, you know, if you're on a bike or even walking, it's tough to get service in those later hours. Now, from the restaurant's perspective, they get very concerned about being required to have those drive-throughs open for cyclists and, you know, in the future, after remodeling or any new ones, being required to allow pedestrians in, from because they take on the liability if somebody ends up getting hurt in their drive-through. So if somebody's on a bicycle and, you know, we say, well, people don't pay attention when they're driving, there could be an accident in a drive-through between two automobiles, but that means, you know, if one car bumps into another because they're texting or whatever while they're in a drive-through window, then you've got damage to an automobile. But if you've got a cyclist between those two or a pedestrian between those two, you get damage to a human being. And, you know, the liability for that is much greater. And obviously the impact on their customers is much greater. So that was a huge concern for them. They had reached out to insurance companies and they said, absolutely, this is going to be, you know, something we'll have to take a look at as we renew your insurance. It's, you know, clearly going to cost more, but it's a liability. And then the other concern the restaurateurs have is pedestrians or people on bicycles could present more of a danger to their employees who are working a drive-through window. And I, you know, when they told me about that, when they approached me about this bill, I was just like, yeah, sure. And they brought up YouTube videos. I mean, there's a bunch of these things out there where people have walked up to a drive-through, you know, under the guise of wanting to place an order, and then they reach through with a gun or they go after the cash register. And it's, I understood their concerns. Look, I'm a cyclist. I've been a cycling advocate for a number of years. I've passed a lot of really good pro-cycling legislation up in the legislature. But when the restaurants came to me with this concern, I mean, I was faced with, I mean, first of all, I don't necessarily like running legislation that undoes, you know, a city ordinance. But I don't know how to say this. It looked to me like Salt Lake City had made what, in my opinion, was an unwise decision. They did not look deeply enough or take into account the concerns of the restaurant owners when they made this decision. And, you know, I don't like the idea of, you know, the legislature pushing around a city, even Salt Lake City especially. But I guess I liked even less the fact that it looked to me like Salt Lake City was kind of pushing around the restaurants. Mm-hmm. And there is one other city in the U.S., I believe it's in Maine. They had passed an ordinance like this, but they had then indemnified all of those restaurants from liability if something happened to a cyclist or a pedestrian in that drive-up window. And Salt Lake City considered that. I spoke with members of the city council. They said they considered that, but decided that they did not have the authority to do it, so they didn't. They mm-hmm. just said, yep, you know, restaurants, you're going to have to allow cyclists in there or keep your lobby hours or keep your lobby open more hours, and the liability is your problem. Mm-hmm. And so based on all of that, I ran the bill that overturned the ordinance. Throughout the entire process, in speaking with members of the Salt Lake City Council, and speaking to Bike Utah, in speaking to the restaurants, I said, look, there is a way to do this. We can be providing incentives to restaurants who are willing to stay open and be bicycle friendly, work with the cycling community to recognize those folks and patronize those folks. And if we can get, I believe if we can show that the market, that there is a need out there, that there's enough need for cyclists to take advantage of restaurants with drive-thrus, I think they'll find a safe way to meet that need. But, government at any level just making the decision that, hey, this is what we want you to do, and, you're stuck with the cost and the liability. I guess that gave me too much heartburn.
No, I was listening in on when the first bill was first introduced in committee, and that was a circus that all of a sudden became out of hand, because then people were accusing other people of being, special protected classes, and
yes,
people were talking about how bicyclists were criminals, which was totally incorrect.
No,
uncharacterized. I know you don't feel that way at all.
No, not even.
But I remember it being very very passionate discussion, which was kind of funny, because I expected it to be very a non-plus or very very minor bill, because there was Representative Coleman who said something about this was an ordinance that imposed risk, as you said, and which is not very normal or regular of cities to do.
No, you're right.
The only other thing I could even think of, like when it came to like requirements of transportation, was like, Mackinac Island, where they don't require, they refuse cars on Mackinac Island. You're only horse and bikes and walking, and that's it. Now, mind you, Mackinac Island is a tourist destination.
Sure.
And they're looking for some sort of theme there. But I found it would a very interesting thing. Where is that line drawn between, community ordinances and community independence versus common sense, I guess.
Okay.
Your
word's not mine.
No.
That's fair.
Yeah. I mean, I thought that having more bike-friendly, ordinances is a great idea.
Sure.
And I
just recognizing folks on a website, developing an app that, there seems like so many ways to do this,
right,
without telling restaurants you're going to do it or else.
Mm-hmm.
And so, it was a tough bill for me to run. It might be the toughest bill that I've ever run. I struggled internally on so many different levels, but I felt like it was the right thing to do. So,
well, speaking of great transition, by the way, of tough bills, public transportation as well as gas tax funding, you also carried the weight on that one.
Yeah, I did.
And that was a particularly contentious, that was a very large discussion.
It was.
That was happening from beginning to end to like last night.
It's never easy to talk about, let alone, propose a bill that has a tax increase in it. Here we are with these pretty substantial budget surpluses, and people are wondering, well, why on earth does, the legislature feel the need to impose a greater tax? When I get that from folks, I try to quickly explain that we have different sort of funding silos, within the Constitution, within the budget. We all know that income taxes, both personal and corporate income tax, all goes directly to public and higher education in the state. Well, what most people don't realize is it's the same for fuel tax and vehicle registration fees. They have to go into transportation funding. Okay, so where we might have budget surpluses, in education funding, which is really where most of the budget surplus was anyway, you can't and you shouldn't take away money from, education surpluses and transfer it over to transportation.
Mm-hmm.
And what the legislature has been doing for the past 17 years is kind of doing that. They've been, rather than increasing the fuel tax to meet the transportation needs, they've been taking money out of the general fund, out of sales tax.
Mm-hmm.
Money that's intended to be there for, the court system, public safety. Much of that money ends up going to education, social services that we need. Those, programs that are supposed to be funded out of the general fund have been receiving fewer dollars because, again, the legislature has not been willing to increase the fuel tax, so they've been taking more money out of the general fund to cover that cost. As a matter of fact, in 97, the last time that the fuel tax was increased, none of the state budget for transportation came out of the general fund. It was all user fee. It was all fuel tax and registration fee. And since then, it has flipped upside down. We now spend more general fund dollars on transportation than we do those user fee dollars. Right. And so I felt like for a couple of years, it's time to steer this ship in a different direction and you know, put more of the burden for funding our transportation system on the users at the state level. So we did increase the gasoline tax. It'll go up 5 cents in 4.9 cents in January of 2016. And then the fuel tax will be, I guess for lack of a better term, indexed with the price of fuel. So once the wholesale price of fuel gets to $2.45, and it's a ways down the road because right now it's at about $1.70. But when it gets to $2.45, then we will start seeing the fuel tax move up with the price of fuel. There will be a cap on it. It's at $3.33, which translates roughly into about 40 cents a gallon. So today we're at about 25 cents. The most it would go to would be 40 cents. And the projections that we saw during the legislative session is it will take probably about 15 years before it gets to the whole 40 cents. It could go sooner, it could go slower, it depends on fuel prices. So that was the first part of the bill. And then the other part is authorizing a local option sales tax for transportation funding for local needs. And those local needs, you know, are at cities, counties, and at transit. And that was a point of contention, of saying that this local option had to be available for all three of those types of needs. And it was something that, as I was putting this bill together, I went to those groups. I went to the League of Cities and Towns, the Association of Counties, and the different transit districts throughout the state. And I said, look, I don't want to be the one to, you know, essentially dictate to you how that split needs to be. Mm-hmm. I want you guys to, you know, lock yourselves in a room, work out what is the most equitable and the one that solves, you know, the greatest number of needs. And they came back to me saying, this is what we think it ought to be. Of the 0.25, 0.1 should go to cities, 0.1 should go to transit, and the remaining 0.05 should stay with the counties. And so that's where I stood my ground. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was able to get that passed in the House. When it went over to the Senate, they were uncomfortable with transit being part of that mix. This is what they brought to me. I don't want us to be in the position of telling them how this is going to be used. They're the ones who are all going to have to work to get it passed because it requires voter approval. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, we won out, you know? Yeah. The bill passed the way it was intended to pass. I think what's real important, especially for our you know, younger folks who are listening in, is I was not at all comfortable with the idea of continuing to put more and more general fund dollars into transportation. I believe very strongly that the transportation system needs to be paid for by the users with that user tax. The other thing that I'm very uncomfortable doing is borrowing more money to fund our transportation system and then sort of handing that bill to the future. You know, mm-hmm. we see that happening in Washington so much. And you know, I got kids, hope to have grandkids someday. I'm not quite that old, but, you know, at some point in the future. And you know, even my oldest son is 22. I do not feel comfortable even saying to him, I want the benefit of transportation spending. I want, you know, a strong economy. And you know, your generation ought to be the one to pay for it. Mm-hmm. So that's what this bill does, is it makes sure that, you know, we have a good system right now. We have the money we need to pay for that system now and in the future, so future generations can have the same economic benefits that my generation and, you know, the generation before me have had without getting a bill for it.
I'm Rebecca.
I'm Danielle.
I'm Crystal.
And I'm Cherry. And if you like your geek news with a bit of a twist, then you'll love
Hello, Sweetie.
Hello, Sweetie podcast brings you the latest and greatest geek news and information from an all-female panel.
We'll bring you the most recent information about movies, TV, comic books,
video games, roller derby, pop culture, and more. Subscribe on iTunes and like us on Facebook.
For your weekly dose of geek culture from a female perspective, tune in to
Hello, Sweetie.
one of the things that has kind of been a part of this conversation, so Class A roads, this is like your I-15s, your I-80s, you know, those have been largely well-funded, well-maintained, and this kind of bill was kind of targeted at Class B and Class C roads, which are like your roads to like Paiute County or Daggett County, which are wholly, you know, left neglected because of our lack of funding. Does this cover that issue, or we had to come back in like 5-10 years and fix it again?
No, excellent question. Excellent point. And that is on the state system, the state roads. That's really where we've been falling short, is maintaining those, we call them level two roads, that are out in, they're state-owned assets, but they're out in sort of the rural parts of the state where they don't get, it's not a heavily trafficked road, like you said, I-15, mm-hmm. I-80, those kind of things. So we've been running about $40 million short every year on proactively maintaining those assets. So we as, you know, shareholders in Utah have these roads that we own. We have not been taking care of them, and that ends up costing us a lot more money in the future because mm-hmm. they need, you know, greater rehabilitation, and oftentimes will have to be rebuilt, you know, far sooner than they would if we proactively maintain them. So this bill, it absolutely provides the funding to address that problem this year.
Awesome. So my last topic, before we kind of get your general sense, is education funding. Was there anything regarding increased funding for higher education or K through 12 at all this year?
Yeah. There was a significant amount of money. We not only were able to fund growth in student population in public education, but it was about a 4% increase in the weighted pupil unit, which is twice what we've been able to do, you know, any time in recent history since the recession. So it was a good bump, but in the governor's budget, he was trying to get about 6%, maybe 6.5% added to the weighted pupil unit, and so we did not reach, you know, achieve that goal, which is unfortunate. I mean, you know, public education needs more money. There's no question about it. But a 4% bump is a good bump. I think as we continue to see growth in the economy, more of that money is going to go there. And now that we passed, you know, the transportation funding bill, we don't need to be taking it away for transportation purposes. Mm-hmm. We will continue to have the money we need to do that. So, you know, I kind of joke and say the transportation funding bill was the best education funding bill passed this year. But reality, it keeps us from taking more of that money away. So more of it can stay in the general fund and be used for education. And I believe, you know, the state's economy is still strong. I mean, we're due for a recession any time because it's been so long since the last one. But hopefully we can stave it off. And if it comes again, hopefully it won't be as severe as the last one. And we can continue to put more and more dollars in public education and higher education. Higher education got some money. They did a tuition increase again this year, but it was the smallest increase that they've done in a number of years. I think it was less than half of what they did last year. So that's helpful, at mm-hmm. least, you know.
Finally, I want to get kind of your general overview of the session. What I noticed from following it, particularly in the House, was there was a lot of exercise of, like, indirect tenuous alliance. Because, I mean, the House and the Senate are a super majority of Republican Party, so the Democrats really have very little play within the legislature, in my opinion, with the exception of a couple of votes, right?
Sure.
There were interesting, like, alliances of, you know, you have rural Utah versus urban Utah, unincorporated Salt Lake County versus incorporated Salt Lake County, you know.
East versus West.
Yeah, East versus West. Yeah, you know, I found it very particularly interesting how and like you had like libertarians versus the traditional neoconservative Republicans versus moderates, you know, Republicans in the House, and how that kind of played out in different ways, and even generational regarding like medical marijuana, like mm-hmm. in the Senate, which, I mean, the Senate is much older than the House is in terms of age, but even still, you saw certain generational aspects to that. And then finally, I mean, what I thought was interesting was that there was a lot of heavy lifting this year.
Yeah.
Like there was almost like it was a cluster of issues that kind of came all at once, and this was all like new leadership there, and so it was kind of like being thrown into this kind of like fiery situation that if you didn't get everything done, you're going to be up the creek without a paddle. So what is your thoughts and feeling on the legislature? Was it a good one, bad one?
This was my sixth session in the legislature. I have never been so proud of the work that was done. I mean, yeah, I, you know, was the guy really pushing the transportation funding, and that was a massive lift. That was a generational change in how we are dealing with transportation funding in this state. But that wasn't the only amazing thing that was done. I mean, the work that Representative Eric Hutchings did on criminal justice reform is outstanding. That is going to do so much for this state, for people with substance abuse issues, people with emotional issues that, you know, they end up committing a crime to satisfy those needs. And, you know, today we throw them in prison with everybody else. Mm-hmm. And it ends up ruining people who absolutely can be saved. I mean, there's two different types of you know, what we would call criminals out there. There's the kind that we're afraid of, and then there's the kind that we're mad at. And for years we've been treating them the same. And what it does is it takes the people that we're mad at and turns them into the people that we're scared of. And it's so wrong. This, you know, I think most people agree the war on drugs has been not only a failure because you're not winning the war, but what it's done to human beings has been atrocious. And this work that Representative Hutchings is doing and has accomplished this year is going to make a massive difference in how we deal with people going through the criminal justice system. And I think we're going to see a lot more people saved, which is a darn good thing. We had the, you know, the non-discrimination bill was finally heard and passed. Mm-hmm. You know, we had the religious liberty bill that went with that. Those were big deals. I mean, if it wasn't, you know, kind of joke that the Medicaid thing overshadowed everything that happened, but you look at those three things being passed in one legislative session. Heck, if Medicaid had not been part of the discussion, if it just wasn't something we were addressing right now, any one of those three issues would have been landmark. I mean, mm-hmm. just absolutely landmark to get completed in a legislative session. We got three of them, and we're going to get something done on Medicaid. It won't be enough. It won't be what I want. It won't be what a lot of folks want, but it will be something, and it will move us forward, and it will provide some kind of help for folks out there that need it. But you're right. This legislature is, we got people of all stripes, you know, all kinds of backgrounds. It's, you know, the age range is, you know, probably 50 years between the youngest and the oldest members in the House and Senate. And it absolutely makes for some interesting conversation. We have a citizen legislature. You know, we don't have full-time politicians that are making these decisions. We have 45 days every year. And that counts weekends. Yeah. I mean, it's not really even a full 45 days. We got our interim committees, and we get some stuff done in there and get, you know, bills prepared for the legislative session. But I think we got a good system. I would hate to see that change, to get, you know, people with insurance backgrounds and teaching backgrounds and real estate. And, you know, I'm in the business of early childhood care and education. I started my career as a preschool teacher, and now I'm serving in the legislature. I mean, it's an amazing process, an amazing opportunity, not only for those that serve, but for everybody that we represent, to have all of this, you know, all of this diversity of background. And yeah, you know, people have different opinions based on the generation they came from, or different opinions based on, you know, other life experiences. And you know, that's going to happen. Mm-hmm. And some of these issues that, you know, that we believe in, you know, again, I'm a Gen Xer. I'm 43 years old. You're younger than me. And mm-hmm. but you know, when it comes to anti-discrimination, we probably look at that a little bit differently than, you know, our parents and grandparents did. And when it comes to, you know, issues like medical marijuana or you know, medical experimentation in other ways, we had, you know, there was a proposal up there about right to die legislation. I think mm-hmm. we view that probably differently than you know, the people that have gone before us do. And so over time, those things tend to change. Nothing ever happens as fast as we want it to, and maybe that's a good thing, you know, because I think we'd be cleaning up a lot of messes if we made big changes too rapidly. But I, you know, last couple of sessions, I walked away from the legislature just kind of scratching my head and going, what did we do? What did we accomplish? But not this time. We accomplished some big things.
Well, thank you so much, Representative. Hey, it was a great conversation.
You bet. I appreciate the opportunity. I know I ramble on, but it's fun sometimes, you know.
Yeah. Well, awesome. Well, I look forward to talking to you maybe next year about the legislative session.
So, you bet. Awesome. I'd love to.
Thank you.
You bet.
Thanks for listening to Slug Soundwaves. For all things Slug Magazine, visit slugmag.com. Send us suggestions of what you'd like to hear on the show by either mailing us at soundwaves@slugmag.com or hit us up on Twitter at Slug Soundwaves. The podcast was created by Slug Magazine and is produced by Gavin Sheehan. The associate producers are Alexander Ortega, Christian Schultz, Henry Glashine, and John Ford. The executive producer is Angela H. Brown. Our show's theme was produced by Temples. Our main logo and art design by Nicholas Dowd. And technical design was by Kate Colgan. Next week, Slug's senior staff writer, Kia McGinnis, will chat with Dusk Raps about his latest album. Thanks for listening.